Good evening. This is Kathy Schmidt-Whitaker, president of CCCLV, Council of Citizens with Low Vision. We are excited to offer this program this evening. Our speaker is an experienced facilitator and has a lot of good information, as well as we will be having a discussion regarding the intersectionality with low vision. Looking forward to that session. Before we begin, I'd just like to go over a couple of different matters this evening. We do hope that we can allow for the flow of discussion, as well as understanding and respecting each other's confidentiality. And so we ask that what is discussed here this evening is kept in confidence, and that you realize that we are being recorded. So if you do say something, please be aware that others may be listening to that later on as well. If you feel that you've said something that you would like to have removed from the recording before it is posted, please let us know after the meeting. While we want to respect each other's thoughts and opinions and ideas, we also want to be respectful with one another. I'd like to ask Penny to share with us the information regarding ACB's approach to sessions in which we're having discussions.
The purpose of this group is for peer support only. It is not a therapy group, will not be facilitated by a health care professional, and does not purport to provide mental health services. Okay.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. As we go through the session, we will share about how to participate once our presenter has indicated that that is allowed as well. At this time, I would like to introduce our presenter this evening. I'm excited to share. Larice Diamond is a member of CCCLV. She's also a graduate student, a doctoral student at Kellarmont Colleges, as believes in the value of individuals, identities, and respect for one another, as well as the ability to share and value our background, experiences, beliefs, and believes that we can grow and learn from one another. At this time, please help me welcome Reese Steinman.
I can hear the sound of pretend clapping in my head.
You're going to change your life.
Because I'm about to.
Thank you so much, Kathy. Before we get started, I would like to create a welcome and inviting space by invoking my ancestors. It is tradition in my culture. So my ancestry is Congolese, Guinean, Scots-Irish, American, Minkwin, as a tribesperson, and my relatively privileged position as a middle-class U.S. woman, and my experience as a queer intellect, academic, and radical Black feminist who has a disability, all influence the spaces I occupy and how the communities with whom I work and serve receive my voice. And in honor of that heritage and yours, I ask you to just take a few moments, maybe a minute, to envision those who came before you, your ancestors, whose dreams and aspirations you embody, their ceremonies and their dances and songs were about you. You are their revolutionary prayer. You are their sacred gift to the world. So thank you, ancestors, for coming into this space with us and helping facilitate it with your presence and love. My name is Reese, and in school, I explore power at the nexus of race, gender, and sexuality. I use a prism that incorporates and applies my embodied experience with theories from radical Black feminism, Afrofuturism, critical race theory, queer theory, multimodal rhetoric, and intercultural communication. And I use those approaches as critical lenses through which I build traditional and digital humanities projects. I respond to, partake in, and craft counter narratives that contribute to revisionist histories and ameliorate settler colonialist epistemic harm rooted in heteropatriarchal white supremacy and culturally misrepresentative research outcomes. My embodied experience as a queer Black intellect accompanies me into the last year of my coursework as a PhD student in cultural studies with an emphasis in media studies at Claremont Graduate University. I'm also earning a certificate in women's and gender studies. I hold an MA in rhetoric and writing studies, a BA in communication with minors in sociology and interdisciplinary studies from San Diego State University. And I started that journey with an AA in communication studies from Southwestern College. Along the way, I've had tons of help from California Council of the Blind and the ACB, who have contributed to my journey academically and financially. I became a Sally Casanova Scholar, a California pre-doctoral scholar. I cohabit the chair of my university's anti-discrimination committee and advocate in community with San Diego's LGBTQ Survivor Task Force. I've had international experiences, which also inform my approach to reading race, gender, and sexuality, and was selected to speak at the UN's 64th Commission on the Status of Women in 2020. I publish articles, blogs, and scholarship across platforms, including LinkedIn, Pearson Education, SDSUB International, Southwestern Community College District, Laysan Race Center for Racial Equity, and my outstanding master's thesis, Implicitly Biased Diversity, and Ideological Aporia in Digital White Space, lives in the ProQuest database. I've presented papers at Western States Communication Association Convention, SDSU's Black Research Symposium, the Conference on College Composition and Communication, and chaired a panel discussion at the Rhetoric Society of America's biannual conference. I am a new university lecturer, a freelance editor, and a social justice entrepreneur who founded and directs Linguistic Communication Development Center, an education-based 501c3 nonprofit organization that centers on teaching practical communication skills to historically overlooked communities. So the first thing I learned as a communication major back in the day was that it's important to establish my ethos. And so I've shared with you a little bit about who I am and how I got to be before you today, leading this discussion. I very much hope that this is a discussion. I've formed some questions to guide us along the way, but mostly I center community. I want to hear your voices, your opinions, and your thoughts. Today's agenda is I will talk about intersectionality and its relationship to low vision for about 15 to 20 minutes, and then open up the space for conversational questions. My only rules are be respectful. As part of the low vision community, I've been in spaces where I hear the connection and the respect that you all have for each other as you hold space and leave room for others to speak. And I hope that tradition continues today. Are there any questions before I begin? So,
no hands so far.
A little bit about low vision and intersectionality then. Kimberly Crenshaw, a law professor at Columbia Law School and UCLA, the term intersectionality, which she used to describe the double bind of simultaneous racial and gender prejudice, particularly pertaining to Black women. It has since evolved into a concept that recognizes that people can experience multiple and interlocking forms of oppression and privilege based on their race, gender, class, sexuality, ability, and other social identities. Crenshaw argues that traditional theories of oppression, such as feminism and anti-racism, tend to focus on identity as a singular dimension, such as gender or race. However, this approach fails to account for the ways in which different forms of oppression intersect and interact to produce unique and compounded experiences of discrimination for people who belong to multiple marginalized groups. For example, a Black woman may face discrimination that is different from the discrimination faced by a white woman or a white man, as the intersection of her race and gender creates a unique experience of oppression. Similarly, a transgender person of color may experience discrimination that is different from that faced by a cisgender person of color or a transgender person of a different race. We see how the legal system fails to account for intersectional identities, such as choosing all white jurors as representative of a Black defendant's peers, or failing to connect all the dots in determining guilt and sentences, discounting factors such as education, economic status, and previous psychosocial harms caused by racism. Intersectionality highlights the importance of understanding the ways in which social identities and experiences of oppression intersect and interact, and it calls for a more inclusive and nuanced approach to addressing systemic inequality. So now I'm going to move to discuss the evolution of intersectionality from legal theorist in the paradigm of critical race theory, such as Crenshaw, Derek Bell, Patricia Williams, Mari Matsuda, to feminist scholars like Gloria Anzaldúa, bell hooks, who make the political personal and academic. We move into queer theorists such as Sarah Ahmed and Judith Butler. And finally, disability scholars. Kimberly Crenshaw has applied intersectionality theory to disability studies. She has argued that people with disabilities experience multiple forms of oppression based on race, gender, sexuality, and other identities. A few scholars in the disciplinary field of disability. Rosemary Garland Thomas has written extensively on the intersections of disability, gender, and sexuality. She argues that disability should be understood as a complex and multifaceted experience that is shaped by social and cultural norms. Eli Clare is a disabled writer and activist who has written about the intersection of disability with gender, race, and class. He has argued that disability is not simply a medical condition, but a social and political identity that intersects with other identities. Mia Mingus is a disabled writer and activist who has written about the intersection of disability, race, and gender. She has argued that disability justice must address multiple forms of oppression and center the experiences of those who are most marginalized. And last, Amy Hamrale is a disabled scholar who has written about the intersections of disability, race, and architecture. They have argued that disability is a fundamental aspect of the built environment, the structured environment, the material environment, and that design must be inclusive of all bodies and abilities. Low vision can have a significant impact on a person's identity and self-perception. For many people, vision is a critical aspect of their sense of self and is closely tied to their overall self-perception and their place in the world. Issues that meet at the intersection of low vision and identity include changes in self-image. People with low vision may feel that their visual impairment has diminished their abilities or altered their sense of self, leading to feelings of insecurity or low self-esteem. Isolation and loneliness. Low vision can limit a person's ability to participate in social activities and engage with others, leading to feelings of isolation and loneliness. Stigma and discrimination. We may encounter negative attitudes and biases from others that lead to feelings of shame, guilt, or low self-esteem. Loss of independence. Low vision can affect our ability to perform daily tasks and navigate our environment, leading to a loss of independence and increased dependence on others. Experiences like those can have a profound impact on our sense of identity and can affect our overall well-being. However, with proper support and assistive technology, many of us reclaim our independence and lead fulfilling lives. The relationship between low vision and identity is complex and multi-layered, shaped by the interplay of multiple social identities, experiences of oppression, and the social and cultural norms that define what it means to be visually able. Using Kimberly Crenshaw's theory of intersectionality as a framework, we recognize that people can experience multiple and interlocking forms of oppression and privilege based on their race, gender, class, sexuality, and ability. Similarly, people with low vision may experience discrimination, prejudice, and marginalization based on the intersection of their visual impairment with other social identities. For instance, someone with low vision who also identifies as a woman may face a unique form of discrimination and bias based on both their gender and their visual impairment. They may be expected to conform to traditional gender roles, such as homemaking and caregiving, while also being seen as less competent and capable due to their low vision. Similarly, a person with low vision who is also a person of color may face compounded experiences of discrimination and prejudice as their visual impairment intersects with their race and ethnicity to create a unique and complex form of oppression. The relationship between low vision and identity can also be shaped by cultural and societal norms and expectations about what it means to be visually able. We may be seen as less competent, independent, or capable. We may feel shame, guilt, or low self-esteem. We may also encounter stigma and discrimination from others, which can impact our ability and our willingness to participate in social and cultural activities with other people. However, we can also find strength and resilience in our identity as people with low vision. We may form communities of support and solidarity with others who have similar experiences, like the CCCLV and CCB. And we may develop a deep appreciation for our own strengths and abilities. We may also challenge and resist societal norms and expectations about what it means to be visually able, leading to more inclusive and empowering communities and sense of identity. Hence, the relationship between low vision and identity is complex, multifaceted, shaped by the interplay of multiple social identities, experiences of oppression, and cultural and societal norms. Understanding and exploring the intersections of low vision and identity is critical for addressing systemic inequality and promoting greater inclusiveness and equality for people who have low vision. And so, I've drafted a few questions for discussion to guide us along tonight. Feel free to raise your hand if you would like to answer. Typically, I would have people just jump in, but in order to maintain a sense of decorum, we will raise our hands, and hopefully you all are familiar with the process of raising hands. If not, perhaps Phil can share the process for those who may not know or may need a refresher.
I'd be glad to do that. Is there anybody who wishes me to read through the instructions on raising hand and raising hands? Okay, hearing no response, Rise, I think you can continue.
All right. Okay. So question number one of our evocative questions to discuss the intersection of low vision and identity. I'd like to know, and please share, how has your experience of low vision impacted your sense of identity and belonging? I know for me, I'll go ahead and get us started. As someone who was diagnosed with low vision in 2012, I was shocked for perhaps the first year and a half. I felt depressed. I thought all of my aspirations for returning to academia were gone. And I didn't know who I was anymore or where I belonged. I was lost. Thankfully, I say with a smile, because it doesn't seem like such a good thing to experience multiple organ failure and end up in a a coma for 4 months. But that happened. I kept falling in the house and tripping. And I finally hit my head so hard that I was hospitalized. And the next thing I know, I was regaining consciousness 4 months later. Apparently, all my organs had failed except for my heart. And the physicians told my family that they should stop life support because if I regained consciousness, I'd be in a permanent vegetative state. However, my son, bless his heart, said as long as my heart was beating on its own to leave me connected to life support, which gave me enough time, which gave my body enough time to recover from the traumas that I had been experiencing through the multiple falls and the byproducts of my depression. And so the lucky part came in when I was being discharged, finally, from the skilled nursing facility 4 months afterwards, when I said, hey, you know what, discharge planner, I can't see well. And the reason I'm here in the first place is because I fell and tripped in the house due to my visual impairment. And so I need and want to go back to school. I need to get out of this depression that I was in. And they referred me to the San Diego Center for the Blind, which was the best thing that could have ever happened at that point, where I learned how to navigate life as someone who has low vision. And more than that, I built community with other people who have visual impairments and who are blind. And I met one of my dearest friends who went into the hospital on an outpatient visit, abdominal surgery, and regained consciousness when the anesthesia wore off, totally blind. She's a mother of two teenagers. And I met her at the center, and she was making her way through her experience, and she inspired me. She showed me that I had no reason to be sad or think that my life was over, because it very much is not. And so that experience at the San Diego Center for the Blind impacted my sense of identity and belonging. I started to regain a new sense of who I am, a new identity as someone who has low vision and belongs in the low vision and blind community. And so again, I pose the question, how has your experience of low vision impacted your sense of identity and belonging?
Okay, we have a hand
Hello,
raised.
Hello, can you hear me?
Okay, yes. We have a hand raised by someone ending in 879.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, you're on.
Can you still hear me? Oh, my goodness. My name is Linda Samolsky, and I used to work at the Center for the Blind before you came. Reese, I left in 2008. But working in the field for so many years, and by the way, I'm totally blind, and I was trying to give people the opportunity to speak before I raised my hand. Being totally blind, I've observed some things that happen within the low vision community. First of all, when somebody gets a diagnosis, after the diagnosis, the family or friends don't realize that it's common that they don't realize what a person can see and what a person can't see. And so they're always, you know, being told that, oh, well, you can see that over there, or look at that over there, or, you know, they're always being told that what they can see and what they can't see by family members and friends. And there's always that push and pull. And then I know that a lot of times the totally blind community depends on people with low vision to look at something or to read something. And so, again, there's always that push and pull for people who have low vision. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that affects, or maybe other people can talk about that, how that affects their self-esteem and how they can find balance?
I will definitely leave that question open for comment. And if no one gets to it, we can come back to it.
We have a hand raised, Penny V.
Thank you, Linda. Penny B.
Penny V. My thing is that people don't think I can do anything. I have a little vision, but they don't think I can do anything. And that's very frustrating. I have a perfectly good brain and I can do a lot of things, but there's a lot of people that just think I need help all the time. The worst one is my own sister, because she goes around and tells everybody I see nothing but blurs. She doesn't know what I can see. And I try to explain to her. I don't know how to communicate to her that, let me explain what I see. You don't have my eyes, so you don't know what I can see or what I can't see. That's so frustrating with to me as a person with a very low vision. Okay.
Thank you, Penny.
We have a hand raised, Shana Ray.
Dana, please.
Sorry, was looking for the mute button or the unmute button. I have some vision, and sometimes I'll be navigating through an area and people will say, "You're not blind. You seem to know where you're going." And I don't think they have any idea what some people think that blind people are either totally blind or they're not blind at all. And there are so many different variations of what is blindness that, you know, people will be like, "Wow, you're out on your own. I see you walking all the time. That's amazing." And it's actually kind of insulting.
Yes. I feel your pain, Shana. And thank you for sharing. And Penny, I totally relate to your experience with your sister as well. My own sisters and friends, they do the same thing to me. And I have to be, it's crazy. And the "you're not blind," I have a baby sister who swears that I'm making this whole thing up. Okay, I see two hands.
Okay, Valerie Reese-Lohman.
Lohman, thank you so much. And thank you for your presentation. I had a friend that's partially blind tell me the other day, and it was very interesting. She said, "You know, we are discriminated against by the sighted and also by the blind." And I thought that was a very interesting concept. But, you know, in a way, it's kind of true. I rarely get an opportunity to tell anyone what I can see. I suppose they figure that if they're totally sighted, that it's rude to ask. But there is that kind of discrimination out there. And I just thought I'd mention that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Valerie.
Okay, Kathy Whitaker has her hand raised.
And it's interesting, a while ago, I had the experience in a work setting where a lot of people were talking about makeup and clothing and a lot of visual things, and very up in, you know, in terms of the latest fashions and dress. And somebody commented to me that I wasn't as included in the group because I couldn't see. I wasn't participating as much. So maybe if I were to become more interested in those things, that I would, I might fit in better. And I thought that was really interesting. And I know there are people who are low vision that that really love makeup and dress and fashion and all that. And I'm not one of them, and I'm not able to see it as much. And so I feel that at times, because I either will need to ask, what's the individual wearing, or how is the haircut done, or it sounds like that individual has a streak of color in their hair, from the comment that I received, to be able to have a better sense and feel more involved or included in that conversation. And so I find this paradox between area of interest, but then also the barrier of the low vision and the visual ability, and agree in terms of we have architectural, we have structural, and as well as kind of virtual barriers that oftentimes limit our abilities as well as individuals, as a person with low vision.
Yes, thank you, Kathy. I often contemplate fashion, haircuts, what are people wearing? And if those cues are important to us in our visual descriptions, when we are, even when we're writing up visual descriptions of what is this image, or who's speaking, is it important to us what they have on, how their hair looks or not? And I guess it is. And, we're not a monolith. We all are interested in different things. And I, for one, was raised in a family where what people, their appearance, right, was a focal point. And so, kind of feel left out sometimes. But I do have an interest in it. And I'm always wanting to know, do I look good today? Right. So thank you for sharing and everyone's response to question number one. Now I'm going to move on to my next question and see if that piques anyone's interest. And of course, I'll give you plenty of time to consider it. It has a few parts to it. So how do different identities intersect and interact with low vision to shape your experiences of discrimination, prejudice, and marginalization? How does being different in myriad ways, like having trouble seeing, affect how people treat you unfairly or leave you out because of who you are and your ability to see? And even that takes me back to Penny, Shana, and Kathy's comments about that experience of marginalization, discrimination. Will you please expound on that, or someone else want to pitch in to respond? And let me know if you want me to repeat the question.
Kathy Whitaker has her hand raised.
Okay, Kathy, please speak.
It's interesting. So I'd like to share another experience I've had where a number of years ago, I spoke at my sister's wedding. And afterwards, after the event, and all that. Some of her friends, she was talking to some of her friends, and she mentioned about her sister, who couldn't see well. And they're like, oh, which sister? And she's, you know, and she's like, oh, you know, Kathy. And like, oh, I didn't know you had more than one sister. And you know, there's only two of us. And she said, no, the one who gave the speech. Oh, really? She gave such a good speech. How could she do that if she can't see? And I feel like we, that as was mentioned earlier, that in society, there are stereotypes that are created in people's minds. And oftentimes it's someone, it tends to be blind or obviously blind, quote unquote, whatever that might look like or feel like to somebody, or they might be sighted. And there's a little for that in between in terms of the low vision, where you may have some eyesight and be able to do some functioning and may need some assistive technology or tools or strategies to be independent as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kathy.
Valerie, I'm glad. Lerman has her hand up. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you. Uh-huh. Valerie, please go ahead.
Just wanted to say that I agree with Kathy and Penny and Debbie. It can be so frustrating to have people not understand low vision. And like people have said, people think, they either think you're totally sighted or totally blind. There's no concept of what's in between. So I get that all the time because I carry a blind cane and I need it about maybe 25% of the time to navigate the street or stairs or dark spaces, maybe 50% of the time. But the other part of the time, it's strictly for identification purposes. So people going visually impaired, let's say when I cross a street or go into a store, etc. And I don't know if anybody's interested, but I've written a couple of articles for CCLVI in their Vision Access magazine about low vision. It's just my sincere hope that the general public can get more educated.
Definitely. Penny, education for the people is important. Thank you, Valerie. Okay, Penny B, please lend your voice.
I am. In the workplace, okay, we would have civil rights training and they had overheads and games and stuff and it on the thing. And if your table won answered the questions quick, they, you know, you'd win prize. It's no big deal. It's just that I would know the answers to the questions when I knew what the question was. I could not see them because they're on the wall and you're sitting back further, you know. I had no way to see what was on the wall. This is civil rights training at a job. And I got really frustrated. I'm a shy person normally, but I got up and says, you are taking my civil rights away from me. Everyone is answering these questions and I know these answers, but I don't get a chance to because they can see what's up there and I can't. And I don't think it's right. So right now you're going against your training. And it never changed. And it was for the county. I mean, these are county jobs. Mm. I was a worker at the welfare department for 25 years. And another thing now I've noticed in churches, they have overheads for songs and stuff. Who can see them? I can't see them. And if I don't know the songs and I don't have somebody standing next to me that pronounces the words well, I can't do the singing and I don't know what's going on. So those are some of the struggles I've been running into right now.
Mm-hmm. Today.
Yes.
That kind of leads me to my next question, actually, which is, in what ways does low vision impede your ability to navigate physical, social, and cultural environments. And so when you talk about the church space, the workspace, those are our social and cultural environments. And you raised, Penny, some very legible issues that are happening there in those spaces. Even, you know, at the doctor's office, they want to, when I go to the pharmacy, they want to put our names on a board. They think they are so advanced by putting our names on the board so we can see them. I can't see my name. Right, thanks. I'm not there yet, but you're getting there, right? Because the slider for your credit card, the print on that is quite enlarged and I can actually see it. So progress in some areas, not so much in others, but we keep pushing, right? Would anyone else like to speak to the question of how low vision impedes your ability to navigate physical, social, and cultural environments? I know we talk about it all the time, our experiences at airports and the grocery store. And
you have a raised hand, Debbie Obregon.
Yes, Debbie, please speak to this.
I personally find it very difficult being visually impaired at social situations and even at church, at social functions, sometimes even at big family functions where a lot of the younger generation, we don't see them very often and we don't know who they are. But it's just awkward because we can't look across the room and say, oh, there's Penny V. Let's go say hi to her, you know, like sighted people can. And people don't come up to us, you know. We've had situations where we'll meet someone and they'll, like from church, and they'll say, oh, you know, we've seen you guys for years and we've always wanted to meet you. But it's like, well, why didn't you come talk to us, you know?
Right. But took you so long to come over. Those are two excellent settings for issues, family functions and social functions. Okay. Who's next?
Shana Ray has a hand up.
All right. Shana.
I was going to talk about the exact two same settings. First, in group settings, like I'm a court reporting student, and I've been to several different court reporting mixers where there are, I don't know, 50 people, lots of people, and I can't see well enough to you know, go work the room and, you know, mingle and socialize with people. So I generally try to find a group of people that I know and stick with them. And it would be nice to actually be able to talk to more people, but it seems like people come up to me and introduce themselves, but I feel really awkward about, you know, I don't know who I'm approaching. I just feel really awkward in those, you know, really social situations where you know, don't know where everyone is. And it's the same thing with family groups, you know, I just stay in my whatever group of people I'm comfortable with. Sometimes I will move to the next room because in family situations, at least I know everybody, but it's still kind of awkward trying to mingle in social situations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing, Shana. Yes, I agree.
Nikki has her hand up.
Nikki. Hey, join the conversation.
Hi. I was listening to a program just this afternoon at 5:00. A woman was on Tech Talk and she was talking about cooking utensils. And she said when she went to culinary school, she was the only blind person there. And for several years, she ate by herself in the corner. Nobody offered to eat with her. Nobody invited her out to lunch until finally, after I forget how many years, but it was several years, one of the ladies came over and had lunch with her, or they went out to lunch. And from then on, other people came around, they rallied around. But why on earth would it take 3 years for somebody to go over and include her in the group? It just doesn't make any sense. Is it fear? Is it they don't want to be bothered? They don't care? And these were very compassionate people, she found out later. But I don't understand that either. But then again, one of my friends was going to church with another friend of hers, and when she was sighted, and the people in the church knew her, but they would say, hello, how are you? And that was it. And one time she was alone because her friend had to go organize something. So she was standing inside the area where this event was taking place in the church, and nobody came up to her and talked to her. Nobody came up and said, oh, hi, I've seen you before, or anything like that, and took her around and introduced her to places, you know, to other people and stuff. And it's interesting because it was a white church, but the same thing happened to her in a black church. Everybody came up to her and took her around and introduced her to other people. So is it a cultural thing, or is it, I don't know, but some cultures include people regardless of what, you know, what their situation is, and others don't. So anyway, I'm always perplexed by that. Thank you. I'm going to shut up now.
Well, thank you for sharing. I appreciate that. And yes, it can be very puzzling to figure people out, and then, you know, the in-group, out-group situations. And I mean, what does it take to get into the in-group? What does it take to even get a simple hello sometimes? And I don't think that's limited to low vision intersections, right? You mentioned race and just culture in general, like what are the cultural norms for that particular group? Which it reminded me of even a question I have as a Black woman who has low vision. You know, one of my first concerns was, will I encounter the same type of racial discrimination that I experienced from sighted people and in blind communities? That was a question that was in my head for a long time. And, you know, it finally occurred to me that, hey, just because you're blind or low vision doesn't mean that you don't have those same kind of internalized systemic issues ingrained socially, you know.
Right.
All right. So that, were there any more questions?
There's one more hand. Valerie
Rodgers-Lerman. Valerie, jump in.
I just wanted to just briefly say that it was very odd when I was growing up that no one ever mentioned that I should carry a cane to identify myself as legally blind. I went through college and had nothing that could identify that for people. And I'd have people come by on the street sometimes and say hi and keep on walking. Hi, Valerie. And I'd never know who they were. And it was so sad because it totally took away my ability to interact with people, that I'd never been given the tools to deal with low vision as an individual growing up. I just thought I'd mention that.
Thank you for mentioning that. That is, yeah, it's to me frustrating, right? To be in the room and not be able to see faces, especially as a teacher who looks like, you know, I pass for sighted because you can't tell by looking at me. And even though I tell my students, hey, y'all, I can't see, it just, you know, flies by and we get on with the business of learning. However, faces and names for me are the worst ever. Walking by someone on campus, I just consciously remind folks, I cannot see you unless you are in my face. And that's all I can do, is remind people that I can't see you. And I will be the first one at a huge gathering to stand up and say, hey, just so you know, I can't see anyone unless you come to me and you're like 1 foot away. So I'm not being rude if I don't say hello to you, if I don't seem to acknowledge your presence. It's a concerted effort. It's strategic. It's so many things that feel burdensome to network and be social. It's socialization is such an important part of being human. And I find that, you know, the more accustomed I am to my visual status, the more aplomb I seem to gain with every year in my interactions. I think it might also have to do with my age getting older, but I'm more willing to step out of my comfort zone and let people know what my limitations are, because I do want to be social. It's very important to me. And it's, I'm sure, very important to you from what I'm hearing. And so that is a good segue into the more.
Do you have another hand? Do you want to take?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
Jamie Gibson Barrel.
Bookmark that. Jamie.
Hello. I'm sorry. I joined late. So I think I know what topic you're on, and what you're talking about is, you know, and for me and, you know, what I do in my career and things like that is, it's the stigmas of, you know, job interviews. You have a cane and all of a sudden you're not capable. You know, that stigma out there is, you know, it, you know, I don't have an answer, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's all about, you know, advocating for ourselves and educating them. But, you know, there's so many, especially newly blind or newly low vision individuals, you know, they don't have, they haven't built their own skills, you know, to be able to do that. And then the second thing is, you know, cause you know, I'm helping, my primary job is helping blind, low vision get employment, sustainable employment, you know, that they qualify for, not just give me a job kind of thing, but crossing that barrier with the public is always a challenge. And then the other thing is, you know, if this correlates with it, is, you know, like right now we have, you know, all these floodings and all this disaster that's going all around us. And, you know, something as simple as getting the information for where the sandbags are, if we need sandbags, and then we can't do it independently, and having our own city, county, you know, being able to assist us, you know, some counties will do better than others. It seems like some of the tinier counties in our area is helping, but it's like, come on, talk about stress. You know, I got a river coming in my door. Can somebody help me, please? I can't get it myself. I don't know if this is along the same lines of, you know, since I came in the middle of the conversation, I just wanted to share my thoughts on that.
All right, Jamie. Thank you for jumping in.
And raised Kathy Whitaker.
Kathy, we'll finish off this question for us.
Okay. I it's reflecting upon what you and Jamie had indicated. I think that one of the identities is whether an individual has been born or a young child with low vision or newly low vision. And for myself, having been born legally, you know, with legal blindness, I feel that I've had many more years and opportunities to have the experience and adjustments and so forth. And I also related to the in the classroom setting where students teaching, where students would, I would say to students jokingly, well, if you're raising your hand, you know, it's going to get awfully tired because I'm not able to see it, so go ahead and speak up, and kind of making light reference to not being able to see that well, and that individuals would need to speak up, I think really helped me in terms of my confidence as a person with low vision as well over time. And even walking around and seeing people in networking situations where they're like, oh, I waved to you, but you didn't like respond to me. And I'm, oh, remember, I can't see that well. So I think it's just being able to feel comfortable talking about my low vision and in social settings. And if someone asks, you know, I have a response to how much I see that can be relatable. You know, so for example, when you're at 200 feet, I can see fingers in front of my face. And that hopefully gives them a little context in feeling a little bit more like they understand what it means as well. And so I just wanted to share that I kind of related to what had been said. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for sharing that, because it does segue right into our next question, which is, how can an intersectional approach help to address the unique challenges faced by people with low vision? And Kathy, you gave us an approach, an intersectional approach, right? Considering whether someone was born with low vision or acquired it later in life. Those are two vastly different types of low vision and types of experiences and types of identities, which I'm hearing throughout this discussion, how those differences are manifesting in folks' identity. And I'm almost tempted to make a distinction between people who of those two categories, right? It could be a whole new identity section for low vision people, the low vision born with low vision group and the acquired later in life low vision group. There might be room for that. I don't know. Thoughts? How can an intersectional approach help to address the unique challenges faced by people with low vision?
Your first hand is Kathy.
All right, Kathy.
And I think another group, Reese, would be the transitional group. Individuals that have had a certain level of sight, whether it be fully sighted or low vision, and decreasing along the way as well. And there's a myself included, a lot of, you know, transitions that you go through. I think that there are some differences in terms of the opportunities to be exposed to different resources, different strategies that I have observed just, interacting with people throughout life. And so I do think that there are some differences in terms of the experiences and even the opportunities to some services and resources.
Mm-hmm. Different experiences, opportunities, and resources. Anyone else want to chime in on that?
Penny V just raised her hand.
I have noticed the difference of someone that has been born blind and someone that has had low vision and had vision and then later on in life lost their vision. People
can tell that the person has been born blind is blind, right? The people that have lost their vision later on, we turn our heads, because we saw before, we move our heads and stuff in the position where the person is talking from, and they think we see them. They think we, it's like when I was being trained to, with my guide dog, if you look to where the cars are, the driver thinks you see them. So don't look towards the car, look away. And it's just really hard because it depends on, and they perceive us as being visual.
Yes. Yes, that is problematic, right? Because sometimes when you said that, I recall times where I'm tempted to pretend that I cannot see as well as I can, because it might give people the wrong impression. Oddly. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. I'll put a pinpoint in that.
Donna Sanchez has her hand raised.
Donna Sanchez, please join the conversation.
I'm kind of reiterating on Kathy's, but in a different way, is that for myself, I've had experience of where I'm low vision. I was born totally blind. They removed cataracts when I was 2.5 years old, so I could see. Then I've had cornea issues. So until the cornea got bad, then I couldn't see. Okay, they gave me a good cornea, I could see again. So it's been an up and down battle all through my basically life. And so in doing that, I think I've gained a lot of different insights as to, you know, what works and what doesn't work.
So what's something that works? Since we're thinking,
you just kind of go with the flow and you use your cane when you need to, and you don't use it when you don't have to, or, you know, you still carry it with you. You know, you just do things differently each growth, and, you know, but at times it gets frustrating because you don't know where you are. So right. What am I today? You know, can I see or can't I? So anyway.
Thank you, Donna. I like what you said. Go with the flow. That's the best thing we could do.
Valerie has her hand up.
Valerie.
Hey, I just wanted to say that what Kathy brought up was really interesting. Those, Kathy and Penny and everybody, those that were born with low vision versus those that acquire it later in life. But I'd like to give another aspect of it, which is growing up, I was led to believe that I pleased my parents by answering their questions, indicating that I could see better than I actually could, because that's what they wanted me to be, was someone that wasn't visually impaired, because being visually impaired meant that they had a daughter that they'd have to take better care of, and they just didn't want to go in that direction. So I wanted to say that people that are born with low vision, if they are given the support in the beginning and the information in the beginning, that makes a big difference. But if they're kind of on their own, it's totally different. I just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Valerie. That makes a lot of sense, actually. Okay. Getting people information early, right? Jamie.
Hi again. Okay, so with my low vision, and I wear glasses, you know, that throws everybody off, right? You know, that's when you get the, you know, you don't look blind. You know, you don't act blind. And in the beginning, that used to just get me so upset, especially newer to the more vision loss that I have. But what I do now is when they're making those remarks, you know, I sincerely thank them. I go, oh my gosh, thank you. Thank you for saying that. Or you know, and it throws them off. Like, they're like, wait, what? Why are you thanking me? You know, I just tell them, I said, because you're seeing me, the person. I am blind. I am low vision or whatever the conversation is, but you don't see that in me. You know, I'm carrying myself very well. And they, you know, they usually, you know, it sets them back. It makes them think about what they said. Mm-hmm. And now I thank them. And I'm a lot more comfortable now, you know, when they say those types of things to me. But yeah, I throw them off by saying thank you, you know, because I don't know what their perception is. What does blind look like to them? I have no idea. I take it as a negative thing, right? Are you thinking I'm like, I don't know, Ray Charles? I'm not, you know, swaying back and forth. I'm not, I don't know. I have no idea what they're thinking, but I just thank them. So all right. That helps for me, the community.
Okay. Well, there definitely is a stigma attached to disability, especially the kind that people can see, right? So if they can't see the disability, it becomes a different sort of thing, of stigma, the unseen. All right, I'm going to move us on to what is probably going to be our last question of the evening. So let's see which one looks the best. Yay, I like this one. How can we use our own experiences and identities to build bridges of empathy and understanding with people from different backgrounds who also experience low vision? So within our own community, we have people from different backgrounds and identities. How can we build bridges of empathy and understanding with them? For one, let me start us off. I would say to create a welcoming environment, to welcome people, especially new people who enter our spaces that we've never seen before. We've never seen their name, or we've never heard their name. It's so important for our socialization. We've talked a lot this evening about our human need to be acknowledged and to be embraced as a fellow human being on this planet, and especially in certain social and cultural spaces that we travel to. And so why not be the first one to say hello?
Kathy has her hand up.
Kathy, join in.
Yes, I like that, to say hello and to be the first to approach. Oftentimes that's a strategy I use in some networking situations to meet other people. Within the low vision community, I think it's also respecting each other's experiences. And so in regard to Valerie's comment about her experience growing up, yeah. You know, we have multiple experiences and multiple perspectives, and to acknowledge and validate that. And Valerie's experience growing up was just as valuable as mine. And because we have had different experiences, all of us, and we come from different backgrounds and different opportunities to be mindful that we may all not approach the same something the same way. We may use different tools. We may use different strategies. However, hopefully, you know, we have a common interest in terms of support and community being low vision and some commonality, and looking for those opportunities for commonality, as well as things that make us unique, and appreciating each other's experiences.
Yes, Kathy, very nice. Commonality, right? Finding that common ground is the bridge. Saying hello and being the first to approach, respecting our diverse experiences. I feel.
Yes, we have a phone ending in 879.
Okay. It's Linda again.
Linda,
I want to go back to the issue of totally blind and people who have partial vision. I think those of us who are totally blind need to be more empathetic towards people who have low vision, and we need to form better teamwork instead of asking so much from those who have low vision. We need to be able to, for lack of a better word, I'm not real well spoken, but for lack of a better word, maybe we need to form teamwork and acknowledge the things that people with low vision do to help us out, and so we can work better together in advocating and even peer support, giving peer support.
Okay. Work together as peers. So I hear you saying that the blind community could be more empathetic toward those of us who have low vision. And yes, perhaps if that occurred, we could have higher quality teams or coalitions working together, right, to advance our common cause.
Yes. Right. Love it.
Okay. Thank you so much, Linda. And even the other way around too, I think just an overall higher empathy for each other, even, you know, mm-hmm, people who have low vision could be more empathetic toward those who are totally blind, and more embracing of people's capacities and experiences and perspectives. It's easy to tune out when it's not your group. Mm-hmm. And it, yes, a more concerted, a more intentional effort to listen more. Okay. Anyone else on building bridges? Jamie,
yes.
Hello. Yeah, on the building bridges, you know, between what we were just saying, you know, the low vision with the totals. I have a friend who's actually on this call, which I'll leave her nameless, but we make a great team when we're out in public, because there are things that I'm the low vision and I miss, and then she, who's a total blind, catches it. And I'm like, what? Where's, no, Jamie, it's over here. I'm like, how did you do that for me? Right. So, you know, it's a great partnership. I can promise you that. I just had to share that.
Thank you for sharing. That was well worth the listen. And so that will conclude our questions for this evening. Thank you so much for your participation. I've gained so much information and knowledge from you all, and I feel personally more connected to each of you after this talk tonight. So, I think tonight has been a bridge building effort in itself. And I do believe that Kathy has some concluding comments or something that she wanted to cover before we leave tonight. And so I'm just going to say again, thank you. Remember to embrace your ancestors in all that you do, and remember that you are the manifestation of their dreams. Kathy.
Thank you, Reese. Virtual applause for Reese from everyone. Quite an interesting conversation. Appreciated hearing everyone's experiences. Thank you for facilitating and for reminding us how to stay connected to ourselves, each other, and our ancestors. I'm curious if folks are interested in any future discussions such as this. If there is interest, if you could raise your hand and maybe we can get a sense of how many people would be interested in if we were to hold this session such as this in the future. And maybe Phil can tell us if there's hands raised at all. Okay. Well, if not, so we hope that you gained from this session this evening. I'd like to invite everyone to our CCCLV member meeting, which will be held actually next Monday, same time, same place, next Monday. So 7:30 to 9 p.m. Through the Zoom pre-convention, CIFRA CCB. And we will be holding our member meeting where we'll be talking about our constitution and bylaws, as well as elections for our officers. And we hope that everyone who's interested is able to join us. If you'd like to learn more about the CCCLV and what we're doing, please feel free to reach out to myself or Penny. And we are more than happy to share more with you as well. And we hope everyone has a good evening. And once again, thank you, Reese. We appreciate you.
Thank you, Kathy. And did you see there were 5 hands, I think.
Yeah, I caught 6.
Okay.
Wonderful.
All right. Have a good night.
We'll be talking in the future about possible programming. Thank you. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night. Stay well and be safe. And thank you very much.
You too. Thank you.
Great program, Reese.
Yes. Wonderful.
Thank you.